The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, our first guest is here to tell us about the beautiful and moving histories of four young girls in the Holocaust, and they are all linked by a red jumper. She's been on the show before. We've been speaking about the dressmakers of Auschwitz and also costume history. So welcome back to the show, Lucy Adlington.
Hello, thanks for inviting me back.
You're always welcome on the Lifestyle Show, Lucy. I want to talk about the four girls, which I believe were strangers, but first of all, how did this come about? Was it because you saw a red jumper in a museum store?
That's exactly it, yes. I mean, knitting's always been on my mind because I'm a clothes historian. I'm fascinated by the clothes we make and that we wear. And although I'm a terrible knitter myself, my grandmother made everything in my family when we were little. So, you know, knitting, that noise of knitting has always been part of my life. I'm sure a lot of us have memories of being measured up for school jumpers and that we're always big enough to grow into. Yeah, so it caught my attention while I was researching to write The Dressmakers of Auschwitz, how many prisoners, even in the worst circumstances, were trying to find bits of yarn and making needles and so on. So as I explored that, I was looking in the archives at the Imperial War Museum in London and saw the sweetest little jumper that had belonged to a 12-year-old girl. And there wasn't much of a story with it. I thought, well, who was she? And how did this little jumper, you know, such a soft little red woolly thing, end up in a museum that deals with war? And so that was the start of it all.
Oh, how exciting. I expect then it's great because then you have to do a lot of research and piece it all together like a jigsaw puzzle.
That's exactly it. And I do love it. And I had help along the way from a very dear friend called Elsie. And we scoured every archive. We went on trips. We pulled up whoever we could, you know, making all these connections around the world to start telling the story. And it was amazing where it led us, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about them then. I know that they were strangers. They were ages 9 to 19. You mentioned one of them was 12, the first one you came across. So who were they? Can you tell us a little bit about each of them and how the jumper connected them?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in a way, yes, they were complete strangers, but the connections in their lives, you know, there was always very much that sense of what would have happened if. So the jumper in the Imperial War Museum that started me off belonged to a girl called Jock Heidenstein. And she was lucky enough to escape from Berlin as a Jewish girl in 1939 as part of the famous Kinder Transport Initiative. And so in some ways, tracing her life was relatively easy because I could follow her path through England, through various places and speak to people who'd known her. But in tracing the lives of the other three girls, it was a question of thinking, all right, these girls couldn't escape from Europe as Jock did. And what happened to them? So there are two girls from Poland that I looked into, a girl called Hannah who worked in a ghetto knitting for the Germans, the occupiers, you know, making lovely warm clothes for the Nazis. And the story of her jumper is, it's very beautiful. She actually gifts it to her brother to help him survive while she doesn't survive. She's killed. And so the jumper survives as this testimony of her love in gifting a jumper to her brother who was cold, who was making his escape from occupation. And the other Polish girl I looked at, she was also knitting for the Nazis, but she was literally in a death camp. She was in the extermination camp of Sobibor, and it was knitting that kept her alive. The Germans wanted socks and jumpers. And finally, a woman that many people may already have heard of, a German Jewish girl called Anita Lasker, who survived extraordinary adventures and ordeals. She's very famous for playing the cello in the Auschwitz Women's Orchestra. But she also made her way to England and continued her career as an amazing musician and also as a spokesperson for Holocaust education, saying, you know, we mustn't forget these stories.
Mm, yeah, absolutely true. Did any of them survive?
In terms of did they survive the war? Yes, three of them did. I mean, in fact, Regina, who was knitting in a death camp, she took part in one of the most outrageous events. She was part of an armed uprising in the camp where 300 prisoners managed to escape against great odds. And so you can read about it in the book. You know, they had to put the knitting needles down and make a run for it. Just extraordinary. And it just goes to show that there was so much resistance and there was so much, you know, survival instinct in people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry, I phrased that question wrong because I realised you said that they survived and they wanted to make sure everybody knew about it. What I meant was, did they live to a grand old age? Are any of them still around now?
Anita Laskovalfish is very much still around. Still
Have you interviewed her then?
We had quite a conversation. And one of the questions that struck with me when I spoke with her, she's 99 now, is I said, can you knit? And I think the question must have blinded. She said, of course I can knit. And it's like, because it would have been the most natural thing in the world for a girl growing up, you know, in the 20s and 30s and 40s to knit. And I know a lot of people take it up now, don't they, for crafting and for pleasure. But it was just one of those skills that girls had.
As far as what you do, because obviously costume history, has knitting been around for a long, long time, as in centuries and centuries?
Shall we say millennia? Yeah,
really?
Well, King Tutankhamun's socks are on display in Cairo Museum. They're brilliant. Different forms of needle work. You know, there's the Vikings were doing something called narl binding. Absolutely. We've got knitted garments. And every once in a while, people working on archaeological excavations, they find knitwear preserved in England, even, you know, if it's been somehow preserved in anaerobic conditions in mud, you can find knitted woolly caps from Shakespeare's time and so on. So yeah, a very old skill. But I suppose it's often associated with women's work, which is why perhaps it's been overlooked. And also knitwear, it is hard for it to survive, given that not only do moths nibble on it, also, people tend to unravel the yarn. You know, if your jumper's a bit worn out, people in thriftier times, they couldn't just bob down to the shops and buy another one. You'd unravel it and knit it up again into something else. And so, really, in costume collections, you don't tend to see a lot of knitwear, which is what makes it even more poignant, I think, and what links very well when you're looking at wartime history and Holocaust history, because, of course, with that, you're always just gathering precious fragments.
That's a whole other book, isn't it? You could do the history of knitting.
Well, there are some brilliant books on the history of knitting. I do talks on it because I'm fascinated by the way it links with mathematics and coding. But knitting's also so emotional. You know, the fact that when somebody hand knits something for you, it's really intimate. And I've still got one knitted item left from my grandmother. She's been dead a long time. And I always took it for granted when she was knitting for me when I was a kid. And now I've got one glove left. And I'm like, oh, Grandma, you knit for us so much. And we just lost these gloves, you know. We should have stitched them on elastic, shouldn't we?
Definitely, so, definitely.
It's very, very emotional.
Yeah, when you were talking about them, you know, not being able to just go and buy more wool and they used to undo something, I remember being a small child and my grandma's been gone a while as well. And she used to do exactly that. And I used to have to put my hands up sort of 12 inches apart and she'd wind the wool around my two hands, you know, while she was unpicking it so that she could use it again to make something else.
And how many listeners right now, because I'm doing it, how many of them are holding their hands up?
I was.
Like, don't know what you mean.
I was. And I'm thinking, well, she can't see me. Nobody can see me. I'm not sure why I'm doing this. But yeah, indeed.
Right. And so we're talking about events that happened over 80 years ago to people that, you know, we don't know, we're not related to potentially. And yet it's a sense of real common human connection, whether people are refugees or workers or fighters or whatever it is. I think the knitting is a really powerful way to make that connection across time. I think it's lovely. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking.
And even nowadays, I mean, in 30 years' time, we'll probably be talking about the knitting circles that they had. You know, people meet in cafes now and have a coffee and have a knitting chat, don't they?
Yeah. I love working with some of these groups, you know, hearing them talk. And I love yarn bombing, our local
yarn
post
bombing.
Office. oh, come on, you know what? They're usually done quite stealthily, and things around the town and village, the community, are softened up with knitted stuff. We've currently got on our local post box, we've got an Easter bunny and some knitted Easter eggs.
Oh, that's lovely. Yes, I do know what you mean. Yes, I do know what you mean. That's lovely.
Gorilla knitting.
Oh, and as far as doing the research is concerned, I mean, like you say, Anita's 99. You've managed to have a lot of conversations with her. How do you track somebody down like that? You started off at the Imperial War Museum, but how did you track Anita down?
I only had one conversation with Anita, as it happened. You know, I wasn't able to see her in person. We chatted by phone, and that came about because of another writer who'd interviewed Anita and said, oh, you know, you should speak to her. But usually a lot of it's serendipity, and then you just send a lot of messages out into the universe and hope that somebody will answer. And I essentially just wrote to a lot of people saying, would you like to talk about this? You know, do you know anything about this? And with the internet being what it is, you soon get a network of people who are saying, oh, you must speak to so-and-so. In fact, I actually traced a living relative of Jock Heidenstein, who was the little 12-year-old girl from Berlin. And she's living in Israel now, Jock's niece. And she was really hard to track. And once we spoke, you know, and she was able to then share pictures and letters. And she's even got Jock's school reports from when Jock was in school as a refugee in England, which was amazing. And I said, did you know Jock's jumper is in England? She gave it to the museum. And her niece said, we had no idea. So I thought that was wonderful that we were both able to share stories and fill in lots of gaps in the family history.
Oh, yeah, it must have been lovely for them. And do you do like a couple of chapters on each girl?
I sort of woven the stories together. I start with Jock because a lot of her story gives us background information on Germany in the 1930s and the build-up of anti-Semitism. So you get a lot of historical background. And then I move between them, but sort of chronologically. And it also follows the course of the implementation of the Final Solution, to put it bluntly. You know, it's following the course of Nazi policies of bigotry and plunder that end up with mass murder. And so we can see how that plays out by following the life and fate of each girl. And that includes, it includes murder, it includes resistance and rebellion and survival.
Mm. We all know that Nazis' aim was to eliminate all traces of Jewish existence. So it's great that you can find scraps of evidence that prove it all, isn't it? Prove it's all true.
Absolutely. And although, I mean, the subject matter is, of course, tragic and it is heartbreaking, what I found all the way through was that the knitting connection gave a very strong sense of love. And that's how I finished the book, because although there's so much loss, all the way through it, the girls talk about their mothers, you know, and the connection with their mothers and that mother love running through it. And I think of the mothers, you know, teaching them to knit. And so those intergenerational connections are very heartening. And I think it's very lovely now when we talk about community, we talk about close-knit community, you know, even in the word, just people looking out for each other. So still relevant nowadays for us all, I think.
That's incredible. I never knew that. That's a new one on me. Well, I know we've spoken about some of your books before. I remember The Dressmakers of Auschwitz, which was incredible. Stitches in Time. I'm intrigued as to one, because there's too many to mention, but Red Ribbon, is that a similar story? Is it a red ribbon that connects them all?
Yeah, that was a fiction story that I wrote. Ah. It's a young adult. And I wrote it because I'd been wanting to find out about the fashion salon in Auschwitz and couldn't. You know, I'd just seen a mention. And so I concocted a fictional, you know, an imagined story of what it would be like to sew in really extreme circumstances with a red ribbon representing hope running through it. And actually, it was in writing that novel that I was able to write the true story of the Dressmakers of Auschwitz, you know, because the novel became known and people got in touch and we were able to uncover various testimonies and interviews and so on. So, yeah, there is something about red, isn't there? It's a really powerful colour.
Yeah.
And the idea of a red running through something.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Well, it's always a delight to chat to you, Lucy. The book we are selling, as always, on our website, tre.radio, for our listeners, simply click on the bookshop banner. It's called Four Red Sweaters, Powerful True Stories of Women and the Holocaust. And it is, of course, by Lucy Adlington, who we're chatting to now. And Lucy, if people want to know about all your other books and your talks and what you do, do you have your own website?
I do. You can either look under Lucy Adlington or History Wardrobe, which is my company, and that will list what I'm up to, where I'm talking. It doesn't give any hints as to what I'm writing about next.
Ah, that was going to be my next question. Whatever it is, make sure I can interview you about it.
Oh, you're going to love it. If I can get this one off the ground. I've decided to have a little break from history. Well, no, not a break from history, a break from nonfiction. I'm writing a novel and I'm having so much fun with it. And let's just say it's starring char ladies.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. So I hope I will be back on it.
Keep us posted, Lucy. Thanks so much. You have a good day.
And you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.